Good morning, Justin.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Good to have you back. Matt,
it's good to be back.
Matt Lewis, our normal conservative partner here in the DMZ on vacation in his traditional summer watering hole of Arizona. But Justin has been a frequent conservative contributor here. It's always good to have you on. Tell folks again where you are coming from and what you normally do.
I'm the online editor for the Washington Examiner. It's a magazine based in D.C. that covers national politics. So I run a lot of social media.
Would you say the Examiner has a conservative bent, or is it pursuing a more neutral brand?
We have a conservative opinion side, unabashedly so. We're pursuing a straight news angle rather than going into the partisan news side.
Well, some of the opinions can be idiosyncratic. It's not just it's not just talking points.
Yeah. I mean, we have a mix of social conservatives and libertarians and people who are more hawkish, people who are more isolationist. So we publish quite a range on the right side of the aisle.
Yeah, you all can get along in the break room,
I suppose.
You know, we do talk a lot on the show about the various warring factions in the Republican Party because that's generally entertaining. But we did have a bit of a rift open up on the Democratic side with this now famous interview Hillary Clinton gave to The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg, and as is the case with lots of Clinton remarks, they get heavily analyzed and scrutinized, and presumed political calculations being thrusted upon what's on the page. What was your initial reaction to the interview?
Two things. The first is that I think that someone who voted in 2002 to authorize war with Iraq, and who has consistently been on the interventionist side of the aisle, at some point you might say that that just reflects her political sensibilities and her intentions. But I do think, to a certain extent, that she is ultimately a Clinton. The Clintons are really good at politics, and they recognize that when the public perhaps sees an administration that's not doing precisely what it would like, or sees perceived to be weak on foreign policy, that the Clintons will, of course, triangulate to the best of their advantage. They're really good at that. I mean, Hillary is, I think people are, to a kind of an odd perspective, tend to underrate her political skills, and she knows what she's doing.
But
that
is incredibly talented. Do you read the interview as an exercise in calculation or an exercise in conviction? I mean, obviously there could be elements of both.
I think she's very convicted in her calculations. I think there's a strong core there that she is certainly of the liberal interventionist school. I mean, her husband did the humanitarian game back in the 90s, and she was quite aggressive with that in her tenure at the State Department. So I don't want to say that it's all just fluff and that she's positioning for 2016. I think the way that she framed some of it certainly should just be seen as political triangulation.
I mean, because I felt
it's one thing to say, like, there is, like, you know, we need to be stronger on Syria, or that we need to take a different look at the Israel-Gaza issue. It's another to frame it in the way that she certainly did. And, well, I mean, this is politics. Ultimately, it's one thing to think something, but if you don't say it in the proper way, it won't be noticed. Of course, for Clinton, that's not really a concern.
Well, but I would think that, you know, being good at articulating your views is different than crude political calculation. That suggests
the Clintons are never crude. They're not. I mean, they're skillful. There's a distinction between
absence of a principled core. You're just taking the position because you think it will do you short term political good. But if you're saying that she is a diehard liberal interventionist, and she's just figuring out the proper language to articulate her policy views, that seems to go.
I certainly don't think it's that. I think Hillary Clinton is going to be whatever the Democrats want her to be in 2016. And I mean, that will be somewhere between I don't imagine that Democrats are going to turn hardcore anti-interventionists. That will take a Republican president for them to return to those roots. But there is, in Hillary, certainly a willingness to recognize that one can finesse that distinction. And frankly, I don't think it really particularly matters to her where she comes down on that, provided that she wards off any threat to her left and that she looks strong coming into a general election. I mean, she's not Barack Obama. She has done sort of a, I don't know if you want to call it an apology tour, because I don't want to get into the dumb political sloganeering, but she's had to do her rounds of remorse over her 2002 vote, and you know, we will see. So, I don't think this is a matter of her trying. I think you're wrong about her, the way that she's trying to finesse out the proper position. I think she's trying to. It's not a matter of her dealing with her convictions. It's a matter of her dealing with her conviction that she wants to be the president of the United States. And so it's a matter of how you get from point A to point C.
But if the goal is to not go beyond, you know, the Democratic primary voter's comfort zone at this stage of the game, you would think she would be very bland on the subject of foreign policy and not invite an opening for a primary challenger to get on her left on certain issues. So, yeah, this struck me as more of a dare. I dare you to come at me from the left. I'm Hillary Clinton. I have a deep base of support. I have deepest support in the Democratic Party that I've ever had, and I'm very well positioned for the general election. And so I'm going to say what I'm going to say. I'm going to articulate my views as they are, and I dare you to do something about it. I thought she was really trying to be very forward.
You really think she wants to do that? I mean, that worked really poorly for her in 2007.
Well, I think this is very different than a 2007 Hillary. I mean, that Hillary was had a very difficult
time. Yeah, she was 5 years off of voting to go to war with Iraq.
Well, right. I mean, I think she had a very difficult time explain that vote. You know, she didn't want to apologize for it, but she didn't quite renounce it either. And there are a number of other tricky issues. I mean, people forget that the immigration issue, particularly in terms of providing driver's licenses for the undocumented, was one of the key stumbles that made people that she couldn't give a straight answer on and seemed to be taking all sides of the issue. That kind of elevated all this concern of her as an overly calculating, overly cautious, soulless politician that Obama very deftly exploited. This interview seemed to be a very authentic interview with not a lot of coy calculations, not a lot of trying to play all sides, just sort of laying out there. This is who I am. I agree with Obama on this. I mean, she had this very robust defense of the Libyan intervention that I thought was even a stronger defense of what Obama himself gave to Tom Friedman last week. I criticize Obama here on Syria. It's a disagreement that's been reported on before. And even in her Israel discussion, where she's giving this very stout defense of Netanyahu, she also kind of throws in there, you know, he's not easy to work with, which to me is the kind of you could pluck out of context and throw back in her face. Down the line, suggests that she's not down with Netanyahu and ignore the rest of the context of the interview. There wasn't a lot of cautious language in there. It just seemed to be a very, the kind of conversation that you might normally have when, you know, cameras aren't on you and you're involved in politics professionally. So the one element of it that struck me as not unvarnished and more traditionally cautious was the part where she says, "Don't do stupid stuff, it's not an organizing principle." And then she says, "Well, what is?" And then she goes, "Peace, prosperity, and progress." Well, that's not an organizing principle either. That's more kind of poll-tested political talking point type stuff. So I wouldn't argue that she has gone total Bullworth here and, let the fur fly for the next 2 years. So there's some degree of caution that remains, which is to be expected by any politician. But relatively speaking, I thought this was a big step forward in her saying, I'm at a point in my political career and in my life where I've been through the ringer so many times that I think I can run this way and fully be myself and win on that score and not worry about all the political angles this time around.
I think you might have thought this through a little bit too much, to be honest, because I'm not sure she's really thought it through to that extent.
Well, that could well be the case. I mean, this might be, you know, she let her guard down for a day and might reconsider and become more cautious because of all the ramifications that have happened afterwards. She did, you know, call Obama the next day. They put out a statement saying it's not intended to be an attack on him. But
I mean, that's all. I think most of the fallout of that, it's silly. I don't care if Obama's offended. I was amused by Axelrod, not so much concerned about what it actually meant. It seems that a lot of the split tends to be on the elite level and not so much on the level of people who will be more concerned when it comes to voting and elections that are beyond the zip codes that surround the Beltway.
Well, that's sort of my remaining question. Does she pick up the phone and call Move On, you know, which fired off an email criticizing her in pretty harsh terms? Does she want to talk to them and say, no, you got me all wrong here. I'm not some sort of Bush neocon hawk. You're misinterpreting this. Does she want to mend those fences now? Or is she saying, look, I don't care. I'm happy to have this debate with you because I am an interventionist. I'm going to be an interventionist. And I want a mandate for my interventionism. And I'm not going to kowtow to you just to possibly dissuade, you know, a Bernie Sanders or a Brian Schweitzer from getting in because I can take those guys on. If she starts, you know, kissing up to those folks more, then I might treat this more as a one-off example of excessive casualness and not a plan of attack for the future.
Who knows? It's August of 2014.
Yeah, but think
if either one of us knew the answers, we wouldn't be in this field. We'd be doing campaign consulting, making a lot of money. Because you can still fleece campaigns for a lot of money for that kind of advice, be it correct or not. Well, more so on my side than you guys have done a better job of cleaning the ranks. But, you know, here we remain. I'm not sure how Hillary's going to approach her left flank. I think most of the Elizabeth Warren stuff is talk that doesn't extend much beyond talk, and that there is no real organized campaign to have a challenger to Hillary.
And, well, I think, you know, I mean, I do think, I think Bernie is nothing. Real. I think Warren's not going to happen, but Bernie Sanders is out there.
So what? I mean, Bernie Sanders knows very well what his, I mean, where his ceiling is going to be, and it's not going to be something that will threaten Hillary to any extent that will make her be concerned. And honestly, Bernie Sanders is probably good for Hillary because he is going to attract those diehard people on the left, and he's going to siphon them off from any person who tries to position themselves between the two. I don't think Hillary worries about that one bit. She probably wants to take him to a dinner.
I don't necessarily disagree with that, and I think. And you read the Bernie interviews, you see he's fairly respectful towards Hillary. The last one he did was probably the harshest he's been, where he says, you know, we shouldn't annoy anybody. And, you know, I don't know what kind of president she would be. What's her agenda? She hasn't articulated one. You know, that's as tough as he's gotten. You know, Brian Schweitzer was much, much harsher when we talked about her. Every time he talks about her, he's pretty harsh about her. But I think there's a lot less, you know, he's been really ridiculed more. You know, Bernie has been kind of just ignored in a lot of ways, but he seems
going to be. I mean, he realistically speaking, his political campaign will be an effort to get on stage at debates to make Hillary answer questions about certain issues he would like to see discussed that he thinks will otherwise be ignored.
Right.
That's what the campaign will be. It'll be to force her to discuss things that the left is more concerned about than she. And were he not to campaign, they probably would not be discussed at all.
Right. I think that's that's the intent there, is to try to
keep her from drifting
too far right by not having any counterweight on the left in the primary process.
Right. And so it's she knows quite well that if things persist and if the economy continues to improve coming into 2016, and if things begin to calm down at all, that she has a very, very solid chance of becoming the president of the United States come January of 2017. So for her, a lot of it is just chill. I mean, she can sit there and she can casually chat with Jeffrey Goldberg, and she can lay out some things. And she could flip those in 6 months. And I'm not sure that anyone who had the ability to change anything about her candidacy would be able to do anything.
Well, that's why, I mean,
the fact Clintons are so good at floating the trial balloon. And then, if it fails, oops. But I just don't see where there is consequence to it. It's a...
Well, this is the question. If she is in such, if she's in the catbird seat, I mean, that's the kind of situation that can create, paralyzing caution. I got this in the bag. Let's just not do anything controversial and just keep our mouth shut and we'll coast in. This would suggest that she does not want to fall into that trap. She wants to put some stuff out there, even if it ruffles some feathers, even if it's not, purely poll tested stuff, to make clear that there is a reason for this candidacy. There is a vision that she has, and she's keeping that foot on the gas pedal and not staying idle.
Maybe. I mean, if she was doing that, I think her book would have been more aggressive. I think she would have been making more waves. Who knows? Again, there's not even a midterms yet. We don't know who will even control the Senate come the spring. So, I mean, it's one thing to say that I will. I mean, she doesn't know yet whether she's going to be running to preserve and extend elements of the agenda of her predecessor, or if she's going to be running to change a Republican senator, or if she's going to be trying to blaze some kind of new trail, or if she wants to come up with some new creative slogan that can be relentlessly mocked that will probably resonate better with the grassroots anyways. I mean, so much of this is speculation that ultimately is pointless because we don't know where things will be in 3 months.
Well, speaking of that, I had an article about the midterms at theweek.com on Monday, helpfully titled "Why the GOP Should Tank the Midterms," which shockingly, the conservatives that engaged me on Twitter did not embrace, take as a serious, helpful suggestion.
Well, you were wrong, so that's probably one reason.
Well, let me give a minute to say why I'm right, just for fun.
What was yours?
So you look at how Republicans have run the House in the past year and a half, it's been kind of painful to watch. It's not a unified party. It's not a party where the rank and file has much respect for the leadership. Anytime that the leadership tries to do something with a modicum of political pragmatism, it gets mocked and often blocked by the rank and file. Anything that has a positive policy agenda that just has some calibration towards the middle gets dismissed, and Boehner doesn't have the chops to force the rank and file to follow his lead. His general attitude has been to follow their lead in those circumstances, sometimes into a wall, like the shutdown. I'll let these guys have their fun for a couple days and embarrass themselves, and then I'll reassert my authority. So it's not like the House is totally off the rails. I give Boehner credit for constraining the Tea Party. Shutdown didn't go on too long. He managed to jam through disaster relief and expand domestic violence protections for LGBT victims. When there are certain situations like shutdown where it's particularly ugly, like immigration, where similarly Ted Cruz came in with this ridiculous demand, we have to scrap Obama's executive order or no funding for the child migrant border crisis. And now every Republican in the House is on record for deporting Dreamers, except for a handful of Republicans. You've had all these kind of scraps that just generally make the Republicans seem like a disorganized, chaotic, and kind of extreme party. And without having resolved those internal issues, where you have a unified agenda and a unified sense of strategy, you win the Senate, all you do is export your civil war to another body of Congress where these kinds of fights will get even more attention. You now have even more responsibility to govern the country because you completely control Congress. And if the Tea Party uses that to make more mischief that is not easily controlled, it only makes the Republicans seem not ready for prime time, which drags down the presidential candidates. So wouldn't they be better off? Look, they're going to win a handful of Senate seats no matter what. They're going to win at least three by almost any analysis of the situation. They need six to take over the Senate. Why not win three, four, or five? You know, show some momentum, some sense that the country's turning your direction. But without the actual responsibility of running everything, that would create more and more pitfalls for Republicans to fall into. So where does that logic fall apart, in your opinion?
At the very core of it, the goal of the Republican Party is to pass laws that will put the country in a more conservative direction. The 2016 is not going to be good for Republicans running Senate races. We had a huge wave in 2010. We're unlikely to repeat that. Right now, what we're trying to do is to push back against the wave of Democratic Senate wins in 2008, accompanied in large part because they had a candidate who produced one of the biggest turnouts in recent memory. But broadly speaking, because Mitch McConnell wants to have control of the Senate so that he can have more say in how Obama nominates judges and how we do executive appointments, and because the point of controlling the Senate is so that you can pass a bill in the House that you can then bring it to the Senate and ideally send it to the president's desk. And it's pretty dumb to say that we should hold back out of fear of the Tea Party because it might impact the 2016 race that we're, I mean, uncertain to win and certainly unlikely to be able to turn 49 to 51 in 2016. It's just probably not going to happen.
Well, I mean,
we're
quite
likely, in fact, to lose Senate seats in 2016. So the question is, ultimately, you want to put people of your party in positions of power because putting people in positions of power ultimately forces them to pick leadership. And if the leadership is unable to get things done, you put them in the spot where they, in fact, are able to know that.
I mean, what
does surprise me on a certain end is that I think people pretty consistently misread the House. I mean, the problem about Boehner isn't that he can't lead. I mean, to use like Ron Fournier's diction, the problem with Boehner is that he has no structural power over his members. The party no longer controls fundraising. He will have an extremely difficult time primarying out members because how do you primary out members? You have districts that are drawn in certain ways. And he himself, what is he going to do? He's tried to take away committee chairs. It didn't work very well. It produced a backlash, in fact. The problem for Republicans is not what they're going to do with the House, because I mean, I don't know what they're going to do with the House. It's that they have to figure out what they can do in the Senate. They're going to have bills that they can take up if they win a majority come the spring, and some of those bills will pass, and many of them will fail because there's no way they'll clear 60. And so it's going to be relative stagnation, but at least it's stagnation on their own terms as compared to a theoretical case whereby not having the majority but being close to the majority gives them a strong case that they can perhaps win an election that they are unlikely to win in hopes that they can then do something theoretical. I think the argument just has no merits.
Well, I mean, I think the end goal in my mind is what positions the Republican Party best for 2016.
No, the end goal is to take the Senate because the Senate is a different institution.
But the Senate only is of value if you control the White House too. As it stands,
that's not true. That's not true at all. The Senate is of value because if you control the Senate and if you control the House, you control 1/3 of the levers of power of the federal government.
As it stands,
and if you control the Senate, you have the big piece of the say over what you do with judgeships. Because frankly, I think that we're pretty likely, if a SCOTUS nominee comes up between 2014 and 2016, to see Harry Reid to just say, and filibuster gone. Because it would not be terribly shocking to see us get in a situation where we can't nominate a Supreme Court justice and to see that come down to that. So I'd much rather have Republican power for that.
Well, but so, number one, as far as the legislative agenda is concerned, I mean, you're not going to get Republican laws actually passed and signed into law so long as Obama's in the Oval Office. And you can already block Obama's agenda with the House by itself. So gaining the Senate.
Well, what's Obama's line? 1/2 of 1/3 of the government is saying this and the rest is saying the other. I'd prefer it to be 1/3.
But there's no practical difference in that legislatively, because you block Obama's agenda either way.
Sure, there is. The practical difference is you can say that we've put these bills on the desk of President Obama, who's refused to sign them.
Well, that only flies again if Republicans have a unified agenda, which I'm arguing they don't have.
You'd arguably suggest they're not going to have that unified agenda if they don't have a unified agenda to present. It's very difficult to convince people who are on the fence to take risky votes when there's nothing to there's no carrot for them. The carrot is that you can say that we're going to turn around, we're going to say that we have these votes that are waiting on the president's signature, that's something. That's an actual electoral agenda, and that puts you in a position where leadership can say, let's hammer these things through and create real compromises within the party that can then produce an agenda, as compared to a theoretical, we're going to sit at 49 and bide our time. Biding time is not a great strategy.
I'm not saying biding time. What I'm saying is that
Under normal
circumstances, you are correct. What I'm saying is these are not normal circumstances. This Republican Party, as it stands, is not positioned to take advantage of what that power would give them to present a legislative strategy that would create a favorable contrast between themselves and Obama. They'd have inter-party squabbles that would embarrass themselves, and maybe at worst be forced to put things in front of Obama that are not politically popular and give Democrats the upper hand by vetoing them. If you don't think that's what's going to happen, then I think
that you resolve these differences by elections, and that the best way to resolve the differences by elections is to actually be passing agendas, and that if the Republican Party is indeed as radical and without precedent as it's claimed, the best way for the Republican Party to probably resolve those conflicts, which come from primary pressure on the right, is to force votes. At a certain point, Republicans will become so radical, those seats will be seized back by Democrats, at which point you'll have to run a more moderate Republican to shift votes back. And the best way to force an issue is to force the issue. If indeed the problem is that people are being recalcitrant on votes because they fear a primary challenger, and that results in a complete cluster in the legislative process, though ultimately you might say the best thing to do is just to get on with it and to make the process happen, to have the primaries happen, to resolve them. The primaries happened, as we've watched in the Senate races this fall. It's still summer. Wow. This summer, incumbents are doing fine. At a certain point, there is this fear of a boogeyman that is the being primaried by Heritage Action and Freedom Works and, Club for Growth, and at a certain point, you have to get it on and do these races.
I would
accept
that.
And that will not be resolved by being in 49 votes. And so, if you want to play the long term game of presenting things for the party that are ultimately unpopular to the electorate as a whole, you kind of just need to have it out. It's better now than later.
I mean, I think they do need to have it out. What I'm saying is, they're better to have it out without having the Senate at the same time and have it out a much
Why?
More public,
it's gonna happen.
Painful way.
I think your case would have more merit if it wasn't being had out in the Senate as we speak.
Now, your other
minority leader of the Senate is being received a very stiff challenge. Incumbents have received hard challenges. They've been well-funded by national groups that have been the desire to flip the leadership of the Republicans in the Senate because they wish to go in a more hardline direction. That's happening. It is a reality.
If they were fully having it out and that process is in the process of being completed, you wouldn't have had this embarrassment with immigration last week. The primary season was very quiet. There's only the Cantor blow up and this little thing in Mississippi, but for the most part, you haven't had a lot of blood on the floor in the Republican primaries. That I think was Boehner's strategy all along, and I credit him for pulling that off. But the idea of doing that was so he would have strengthened authority to be more politically pragmatic, and that blew up in his face last week with immigration. So he didn't get
have found out that he should have just had it out. That his strategy of pragmatism hasn't really, especially in the House, at a certain point, if you are scared to vote until after an election, you know very well the next election is in 2 years. I would be perhaps wrong to be a campaign consultant, but I might suggest to someone that if they're scared of a vote now and they're being told to wait a short time to take a vote because they will then be safe from a primary challenger, that they should just call it quits because they will be removed in 2 years. Either they will be removed or they will survive. And the vote will, if it happens now or if it happens in the near future, is going to be challenged by people on your right, and then you better be prepared for that. And it doesn't matter if you do it now or then. It could even be seen as more honest and, more representative to just do it.
Now, I want to take up your judge's argument, because I do think that is the strongest argument against what I'm saying. That is new power Republicans would have for 2 years if they won the Senate outright in 2016. And there is the possibility of a Supreme Court vacancy, either Boehner or Ginsburg retiring. Or, you know, some of the Republican judges are up there in age too. Someone could want to retire or could have a health problem of some sort. So obviously they'd have strengthened authority to shape that nomination or to block it outright. The question then becomes, you know, at one, is having that enough to outweigh the other risks that I'm talking about?
If you reject those risks,
obviously it does. But if you accept the risks that I'm talking about, you have to ask.
I don't accept the premise of the risk that you're talking about.
Well, right. If you don't accept that, then the whole thing is obviously a cut and dry. If you accept the risk that I'm talking about, then you have to weigh, is getting that judicial power, does that outweigh the risks of other humiliations the Republican Party will suffer by not having their act together legislatively? And, you know, keep in mind, Obama has a role to play here. He can pick a nominee that is considered very moderate and safe and popular. And when he did that with Kagan and Sotomayor, two judges who were left of center but not by any means radical, he was able to pick off enough Republicans to avoid a filibuster. There are a certain amount of Republicans in the Senate who have sort of respect for tradition and precedent and process and are loath to go into a all-out blood feud on the court because they think that'll blow back in their face when Republicans come in charge. So wouldn't it be shocking for Democrats to still be able to get a nominee through who is generally considered favorable to Democrats, even if Republicans had the Senate? And if that wasn't the case, the Republicans blocked it, would that be all that advantageous to Republicans to be seen as that recalcitrant, that obstructionist? Would that hurt Republican presidential candidates if they took it that far? So I think there's a lot of downside on that too, but I understand that if you think that power in and of itself is so desirable that you'd put everything else aside.
I don't think power is desirable. I mean, ultimately, I think it's pretty pointless, but if the concern is that you think the party is too hardline, the best way to resolve that is to take the theoretical and to make it real, to say that we need to quit having these intellectual fantasies that are played out over the internet and instead actually force representatives to take votes. I'm just not sure that it's the best strategy to say we're going to wait and try to resolve our intra-party crisis in hopes that someday we can have a new and improved Republican Party 4.0 that can be more prepared to take the reins and to do things and populate with the country as a whole. I don't think that's a useful reading of the American politics as they are, and I don't think it tells much for Republicans who are looking to, say, challenge a party they see is too far to the right. It just doesn't do much for me.
Well, I want to give you the last word because I have a crying child downstairs I need to tend to. But it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for filling in on short notice. Where can folks find your work?
They can find my work at the Washington Examiner, and I'm on Twitter at JGreenDC.
Awesome. An excellent Twitter feed to follow no matter what your political ideology. Justin Green, thanks for being on the DMZ.
Thank you for having me.
And I think we should have Matt Lewis back next week here on the DMZ at bloggingeds.tv. Take care.